This is Car Expert.
The crazy thing with that car is I did my quickest lap on the first lap out. Like, it just felt comfortable straight away.
I've been on Zoom calls all morning with members of the industry and they've just said, I've got nowhere to go, I'll just shut the joint down.
SUVs actually, for the first time ever, passed 50% market share.
For a relatively budget mainstream brand like Kia to be offering that on an entry-level car is really impressive, and it's just a shame that we're not getting it here.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. Hello to Scott Colley.
Hello, Mandy.
And James Wong, hello.
Hello, hello, hello.
All three of us are stage four lockdown in Melbourne at the moment, and it's sort of hard to get out and about to drive cars at the moment, but I'm keen to hear what you guys are doing during stage four. What are you up to, Scott?
To get my car fixed, I wrote about this in the first lockdown we did, which feels like 18 years ago now. But I've got back into a little bit of PlayStation gaming. So I've been playing Gran Turismo Sport. And then just earlier this week, I got a knock on the door from a delivery man with a Logitech G923 gaming wheel. So I'm now still working on the setup because I don't have a lot of space, nor do I have like a good desk to mount it on. But I've got a gaming wheel and I've been playing some Gran Turismo Sport and also some Assetto Corsa, which is very, very difficult. So I'm working on that at the moment.
Cool. What cars have you been driving?
What have I crashed this week? So the Gran Turismo Sport is sort of a rolling roster. They do daily online races where you just race against strangers from around the world. And my most recent race was at Monza in a GT3 Racing 911.
Nice.
It is more difficult with the wheel than it is with the controller, I've discovered. I thought it would be the other way around, but it turns out with the controller, if you need to snap, you know, you're steering the other way, it's just a little flick of the wrist, whereas if I get it very wrong with the wheel is less forgiving. So I crashed the 911 a few times and my ratings have all gone down and it's all a bit horrific, but it is very good fun.
What about you, J-Wo?
I've been spending a lot of time playing a different kind of racing game. I've been playing Need for Speed Heat on the PlayStation 4, which I haven't actually been doing a lot of video gaming in the past couple of years, but being in lockdown has kind of forced me to really assess my options and try to find ways of entertaining myself. And it was actually a really cool way to get back into it. Something that Need for Speed Heat does is that there's a really wide range of customization that you can do to your vehicles. You can go through individual body kits and do engine swaps and things like that. So I've been playing that pretty steadily over the last month or so and built up my garage. So I tried to recreate my own Volkswagen Golf with a Mark 7 GTI Club Sport and given it a wide body kit, engine swapped a 4-litre V8 into it and strapped a couple of turbos. I've got a couple of exotic supercars as well. So I'm just doing lots of races to earn up money so I can buy the next cool car that I want to buy and just customize the hell out of it and then finish it in a bright green color and maybe add a carbon fiber or metallic finish. So that's been my life.
It's interesting you say you've remade your car in Need for Speed. I didn't know they had a basic bitch GTI mode.
Well, now it's a really big, tough, masculine, wide-body 4-litre V8 GTI that will be very, very not a basic bitch and very, very just cool.
Don't come for me, GTI people. I really like your cars. They're very good.
Remember Need for Speed Underground?
I love that game.
It's really old now, but I still have all of – I think it was on PS3.
There were a couple of Need for Speed Undergrounds because we had there was the first one, which I think had the orange Nissan 350Z on the cover. And then there was Underground 2, which was like underground but a little more overground because it was more mainstream.
Yes. Actually, I think I'm playing that on the Nintendo Wii, so that gives you an idea on how old it might be.
I'm going to have to correct you, Scott. The original Need for Speed Underground had a bright orange Nissan R34 GTR.
Oh,
and
so close.
Underground 2 had a green Nissan 350Z. The reason I know this is because in Need for Speed Heat, if you finish all these challenges, you can get the hero cars from a bunch of the old Need for Speed games. So I've unlocked that GTR and that 350Z for Need for Speed Heat, and it's in my garage. And there's also that really cool M3 GTR race car from Need for Speed Most Wanted. And there's a handful of other cool hero cars from the Need for Speed franchise that you can unlock in this game as well.
People are now going to think we're sponsored by EA Games. I promise we're not. This is just what we've got to talk about at the moment.
I'll take it. Like, if they want to sponsor me or whatever, like, find my Instagram handle, give me a few followers, you know.
Well, if you guys have been playing, car video games, let us know what you've been up to in lockdown at podcast@carexpert.com.au. To keep you updated with last week's car news from carexpert.com.au. And Scully, we start off with the GMAT50 McLaren F1 successor. Wowza. You know what? This thing reminded me of a concept car out of my 1990s Hot Wheels collection. That's actually a compliment.
I wasn't sure for a second there. So, yeah, GMA is Gordon Murray Automotive, and Gordon Murray is the mastermind behind the McLaren F1. And before that, he has a long history in Formula One with McLaren, with Brabham. And he's also designed some Le Mans cars and road cars and all sorts of other stuff in between. But the GMAT50 is essentially his idea of what a modern McLaren F1 would look like. And obviously covering cars, I spend a lot of my time talking, writing, reading about them. So it's kind of rare that something really captures my imagination. But when this was revealed, I spent a lot of the morning listening to interviews and watching videos he'd done with British media, because that's where he's based. And hearing him talk about this, it really sounds like this is just his passion project. It's the baby he's wanted to build for a really long time. And the results are pretty stunning. For one, it looks fantastic. But everything that's going on under the bonnet and inside is like a direct response to some of the criticisms we've read about modern supercars and hypercars getting too fast, too hard to enjoy on the road, and too detached from the driver. So the engine is a Cosworth V12. Does anyone want to guess what the red line is?
Something ridiculous.
So 12,100 RPM.
Jesus.
And the engine actually weighs only 178 kilos. But crazier than that, apparently when they were developing this engine with Cosworth, Gordon Murray gave them this number that it needed to rev from idle to red line and back again. I think the number was 10,000 revs a second or something like that. Mm. And the final result is a car that will rev from idle to 24,800 RPM in 1 second if it had that red line on it. It gains and loses revs so quickly that you're at red line in less than half a second just from standstill with the clutch in, which I know sounds like a weird metric, but this thing promises just to be light and revvy and all sorts of crazy.
That's incredible. Are there any strong similarities to the F1?
There are. So for one, it's been launched without any talk about performance figures, which is really interesting because the F1 was obviously known for a long time about being the fastest car in the world. But Gordon Murray's launched this with no 0 to 100 time, no top speed, and the reason behind that is just that he wants it to be a pure driving experience and the numbers are secondary to that. It's got a three-seat cabin, so the driver sits in the middle and the passengers sit on each side, slightly behind them, although Gordon Murray does say he's improved the space in the cabin. So it's like a McLaren F1, but you can fit three adults, and why the hell wouldn't you want to carry some friends with you? The biggest area it differs from the F1 is in the aerodynamics. Apparently, the F1 actually did have a small fan on board, but this has got a sort of ground effects fan on the back of the car. And what it can do is it essentially allows you to have all sorts of really clever aero effects without having to have a really complex and busy body. So it's got a streamline mode, for example, where the fan spins a certain way and cuts drag and actually provides a 37 kilowatt boost or the equivalent of that by propelling air out the back of the car. When you're in a different downforce mode, it acts like a virtual long tail and really presses the car into the road. There's, I think, six different modes all up off the top of my head. And it's just fiendishly clever. And it's sort of a party piece from one of the best minds in Formula One and then now road cars, putting all these ideas that he's clearly wanted to do into something in one go. It's fantastic. I'm really excited by it.
Let me guess, we're probably not going to get one here, are we?
Well, we don't know for Australia. What we do know, and if we're going to play the guessing game, how much do you think it's going to cost?
Yeah, that's true.
Because the price has been confirmed. This is a test to see if you've actually read the story.
I read it, but I can't remember how much it was.
So $4.3 million before tax.
Oh, wow.
Only 100 road-going ones will be built, and they're two-thirds sold apparently, and they're going to do 25 track-only cars. But for me, and I'm saying this having not driven any of the modern hypercars, so I have no reference point, but on paper, the idea of this excites me more than something like a Porsche 918, which is still very exciting. But the fact this is so unique in its layout, it's got the crazy Revy V12, it's got a manual transmission. There's something about the concept that really speaks to me.
What do you think, Joe? I reckon this car would be right up your alley.
Well, look, I'm a huge fan of the original McLaren F1. It's one of my like childhood car heroes, which I'm sure that both of you have had the same experience growing up with those kind of 90s supercars, hypercars, whatever you want to call them. I think it looks really cool. I too love the concept and all the different nods to the original McLaren F1 design and concept. I'm just not a huge fan. Like, I know that Scully described that big fan thing as fiendishly clever, but I don't know. It just makes it look like a hovercraft at the back, and I don't know if I really want to be playing Diddy Kong Racing with my $4.3 million hypercar, sorry. I think for me personally, I prefer that Brabham supercar.
The BT62.
Yeah, I think that one is, for me, is more of like a classic supercar meets race car design and still manages to kind of maintain roots to its history without being this. I just find the rear a bit polarizing in this car. The rest of it looks great, and I think it's actually quite similar to a McLaren F1 in terms of the design, especially up front.
Those headlights.
Yeah, and the way that the front is shaped and everything is very, very McLaren F1 when you look at them side by side. And I love the three-seat layout, and I think the specs and everything are really cool. I just think that rear of it, I remember when they first showed the rendering or the design of the rear, I just looked at it and I was like, this looks really weird. So if you were to drive one, you'd be looking at the back a lot, maybe unless you're parked in your garage. But at the same time, it's for me, it's just like I can't get past that booty. It's just looks a bit botched.
James Wrong, ladies and gentlemen.
So we'll talk about another supercar, the Kia Rio. The 2021 pricing's been released this week, Joe.
Yes, so we got wind of the updated pricing and specifications for the upgraded Kia Rio as well as the Picanto, but we're going to focus on the Rio for now. So prices are up a little bit across the board because there's a range of new equipment and some new technology depending on the model that you get. So across the range now, there's a new 8-inch infotainment system which brings wireless Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, which is probably the first in the segment in Australia to do so. But it also means that the base price is up by a grand or so, or anywhere between $500 and $1,800, depending on the model. As is standard for Kia, the whole range launches with drive-away pricing. So it'll start at $18,990 now drive-away for a base Rio S with a manual transmission and climbs all the way up to $24,490 for a GT line, which has a turbocharged engine and a dual clutch transmission. So in addition to that infotainment system, the mid-range Sport also picks up key safety equipment that previously wasn't available, which is a big plus, but it's a shame that we're not seeing it on the base grade given how important technologies like AEB are now across the new car market. So the Sport now picks up autonomous emergency braking, which has pedestrian and cyclist detection. It also gets lane keep assist and driver attention monitoring. So it's pretty well kitted out for a car that you can have for $29.90 drive away in manual guise. But considering that Kia puts AEB as standard in a Picanto, which you can get for like $15 drive away, it just doesn't make sense that this car is getting quite expensive now, especially when that mid and base spec car continues to run a quite old and not very powerful 1.4-litre petrol engine with not a lot of power and torque. So I don't know. I know, Mandy, you've driven the Rio Sport before, and the engine's essentially unchanged from that bright yellow one you had in our previous life. But I think when you're looking at the prices now and you compare it to something like a Volkswagen Polo, which already has autonomous emergency braking as standard and a good infotainment system and a turbocharged engine, which is not only better in terms of drivability because it's got more low down torque, and also the car itself is probably just a little bit more refined and more efficient, I just think that the value proposition is starting to fade a little bit. What do you guys think?
I'm curious about some of the other stuff we don't get, because Kia, I understand, has to hit a price point in Australia, but it also is starting to offer some really clever tech across its range in Europe and in Korea. And this is another example of what we don't get as opposed to what we do. So you're probably better positioned than I am, Joe, to actually run through the full list, but there's quite a bit that doesn't come to Australia in the Rio now, which I find kind of disappointing given the price has gone up and it's now essentially toe-to-toe with a mid or top-spec Polo at the top end.
Yeah, I think it's very much a matter of the different global entities that Kia operates. Kia Europe tends to operate very much on its own, and so it tends to offer, you know, different color combinations and technologies and stuff which are more aimed at the needs of the European market. So I'm not 100% sure if the Rio is also made in Europe like, say, the Picanto is, but so they revealed, when they revealed the new Rio for Europe, they have they're going to be releasing quite a few high-tech stuff. So the 1-litre turbo engine now gets a 48-volt mild hybrid option, as well as a new clutch-by-wire manual transmission to optimize efficiency. So that's the kind of tech that we're starting to see more and more in premium European cars, which can, for example, engage the start-stop system at about 20 k's an hour. So it's a smoother coast to a halt while also decoupling the transmission when coasting around at like 60 to 80 k's under low engine load. So it may only save a couple of hundred mils of fuel in the big scheme of things, but in places like Europe where they're so heavily tight on emissions and fuel consumption, it's all these kind of things that make a little bit of difference in official testing. And the other stuff that we miss out on is some of the more up-to-date driver assist tech. So obviously we get that upgraded autonomous emergency braking system like I mentioned before, but in Europe they'll also get an adaptive cruise control system with a technology called Lane Follow Assist. So it basically gives the Rio level 2 autonomous driving ability by being able to keep the vehicle in the center of its lane, keep a set distance with the vehicle in front, and sort of just drive on highways with very to little driver input. You just have to have your hands on the steering wheel, but it'll do the rest for you. And that, again, that's kind of the tech that we're seeing more and more in the premium segments and slowly filtering down into the mainstream. And for a relatively budget mainstream brand like Kia to be offering that on an entry-level car is really impressive. And it's just a shame that we're not getting it here.
I suppose the other question that comes out of the Rio is, what does this mean for the Stonic? Because they're based on the same platform and Kia's now confirmed what the updated little SUV will look like. I don't want to spend too long on Kia, obviously, but do we expect the Stonic to match the Rio's spec, or maybe will that be pitched a little more premium and have a little bit more tech, do you think?
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Stonic, Scott, because that was where I was going next. So following the release of the Rio, Kia also revealed an updated version of the Stonic, which for those who don't know is basically an SUV version of the Rio that they've been selling in Europe and Korea since about 2017. The visual changes is pretty much limited to a new headlight design, but again, it picks up the same mild hybrid engines and the driver assistance tech as the Rio does. Now, the interesting thing here is that if you go onto the Kia Korea website, and if you are able to decipher Korean or make your computer translate it for you is another thing, but there's a lot, it's very limited in terms of the options you can get from Korea. So it makes me wonder whether it'll be a similar story for the Stonic with regards to what spec we'll get here. So I would say that the AEB system with cyclist detection and the 8-inch infotainment system with wireless CarPlay and Android Auto is probably a given, since we're getting that from a Korean-built Rio. But I'd be very interested to see what Kia does in terms of like the mild hybrid powertrain trains or some of the driver assistance tech, given they're a latecomer to the party, and a lot of other models in the segment, say a Volkswagen T-Cross, for example, offer a full suite of driver assistance systems that are filtered down from high-end models. So I think we can definitely expect the basics covered, but it'll just be a matter of whether Kia wants to really focus on being a price leader and offering the basics and, you know, a 1.4-litre petrol engine as a base model and then the turbocharged model as the higher car. It's a bit early to tell at the moment.
And the last news topic of today, Scully, the Land Rover Defender 90 has been now delayed to early next year. Now, I can only think of one reason why.
Yes. Sorry, a mouse just ran across my floor. That's not good. Jesus.
What?
I think so far. We had a mouse problem and we solved it in the first lockdown. But, oh, God. Anyway, so that's why the Defender 90 has been delayed. Let me try to get back on track. ignoring my new housemate. Yes, so the three-door Defender, the Defender 110 was the big news this week. Car Spotters of Melbourne posted on Facebook a photo of a really nicely specced P400 on the streets of what we can only assume is Toorak based on how leafy they were. And the Defender 90 was supposed to be following in October, but it turns out that's not quite going to happen. It's now going to be early next year, and the reason is, as you've probably guessed, COVID-19. So because production of the 110 was slowed down just 2 months after it started up and demand has been really strong in Europe, there's a backlog they need to get through, and it just means that our allocation of 90s is going to come later than initially planned. But the car is still coming, and I'm still very excited about it.
Me too. I'm actually surprised the main reason isn't because of demand.
Well, it's sort of a combination. Because the orders, the production was stopped, there's a 2 month backlog that maybe wouldn't have been there. Okay. And then because demand is high, that backlog is exacerbated. So yeah, it's sort of a combination of factors, but I suppose the positive news out of it is rather than just saying you're not getting it, because obviously it is such an iconic car and a car that so many people have been looking forward to, Land Rover's just pushed it back. And if you've got a pre-order in, I assume your dealer will be in touch with you. I've actually seen a few of the new 110s around now. We were getting some last-minute stuff done before Stage 4 came into force because we had to return cars and do logistics. And there was a fully specced black one on Nepean Highway in Brighton, in Melbourne, with the adventure pack, with the side bags on the outside, with the ladder and everything. It just looks absolutely fantastic. And I know it's not a traditional Defender like a lot of people know it, but I just think it's going to be great. I can't wait to drive it.
And, of course, you spotted it in Brighton, which is a very sort of upper-class suburb of Melbourne, yes. Far away from off-road.
Yes, there is also a Land Rover dealer there.
I am actually a huge – I love the whole retro meets modern look of it. And something that we covered with the VFAX coverage is that even though there's been a backlog of orders and, you know, supply has been pushed back a little bit, Jaguar Land Rover Australia has actually reported around 9,000 expressions of interest for the new Defender. And hundreds of test drives have been booked nationally over the coming weeks, which I think is actually a huge achievement given everything that's going on at the moment and the fact that the Defender is not exactly the cheapest car on the market. So I think we're going to be seeing a lot of these cars driving around, not just Melbourne, but, you know, Sydney and Brisbane and elsewhere in the country in the coming 12 to 18 months.
So, question for both of you. In an ideal world, which body are you picking? Are you going the 90 or the 110? And how are you sort of specking it? Are we going basic with steelies or are we going full-on adventure spec?
Yeah, no, I'm going to go the green, the two-tone. So, the green with the white roof, with white steelies and the 90. That's my dream Defender.
Yeah.
How about you, Jawo?
I don't know. Like, there's so many different options. I remember we've played around with the configurators before and, you know, figured out which colors we like. Obviously, me being the green man in any team, not just the car expert team, everybody team, in every aspect of my life, I'm very much a green fan. But I just think that this car looks so cool and so it's got so many different personalities depending on what you spec with it. So I can't think of an ideal spec off the top of my head.
That's a strong commitment there.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think off the top of my head new cars that have an option of steel wheels.
There's very few. I think you can still get, and I'm going to have to dive into the reviews section, even the news section, I think. We covered something last week, potentially. It was a pricing and spec story on Steelies. Yeah. But off the top of my head, I can't think of many cars because it is, yeah, everything is alloy now, and especially, you know, given light cars are moving up market, it's not even like you can get yourself a you know, 14,990 drive away Kia Rio. I think it might have been the Picanto on Steelies in the base model, but I can't remember.
Yeah, Picanto and Rio both come standard with Steelies still, and so does the Cerato and the Seltos. There's still quite a few cars that have them as standard, but they normally don't look as good. I think what Land Rover's done here is actually designed them to look cool and desirable so that people actually want to buy them. Because, you know, I would think that I'm sure Moco can attest to this as well, that the Jimny would look great on Steelies and a few other off-roady style cars would look great. Like there was that three-door Prado that they offer overseas that I've seen in Japanese spec with steel wheels, and that looks bloody awesome.
You can head to carexpert.com.au, click on the news link for more. Hello to Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy.
Now, we're talking about VFACTS for July for the new car sales figures. I don't really want to know the answer, actually.
Yeah, look, it's obviously not been a great year. There were some signs of recovery in June. It was only down, I say only, but it was down 6%, whereas in July it was down just under 13%. So after showing some good signs in June, things did take a bit of a turn for the worse in July. There were 72,500 new vehicles sold during the month, and that's 10,700 less than the same month last year. Shouldn't surprise anybody, but the biggest chunk of that decline came from Victoria, which is where we all are. Obviously, now we're in stage four lockdown, but even during July, Victoria was in stage three lockdown. Dealerships were open, but obviously everybody was staying home a little more than they usually would. So about 60% of the national drop came just from Victoria. So the rest of the country isn't doing that badly. New South Wales was only down 8%. Queensland down 9%, and South Australia, WA and the Northern Territory didn't do too badly at all. So things are almost getting back to some normality there.
What were some of the top selling brands for last month?
Well, as ever, it was Toyota in number one, down 13%, but still with 15,500 sales, so more than double its nearest competitor. Mazda was in second, down 5%. So in real terms, actually a gain in market share for that company. Mitsubishi third, Hyundai fourth, and breathing down its neck by just 9 sales behind was Kia, actually up for the month. Ford, Volkswagen, Mercedes-Benz, Nissan and Subaru rounding out the top 10. There were a couple of brands that bucked the trend. We saw Suzuki grow by 27%. Audi grew by 53%. Wow. A lot of that because of better supply that didn't really have last year when it was doing a lot of fuel economy testing in Europe. WLTP, long story, but it couldn't get stock last year. MG from China up nearly 60%. Finished 15th for the month, MG. So that, you know, is now a genuinely mainstream brand. LDV, another Chinese brand, up 22%. Volvo up 23%. And Jeep showing some signs of recovery. I noticed that, Scott, you filed a story talking about Jeep's recovery after a woeful couple of years there. That's grown 20%. And another Chinese brand in Havel also grew by 140%. So there were some smaller brands growing, but from the top 10, only two brands didn't go backwards to a significant degree during the month.
Moco, you mentioned supply there, and it seems like with factories shutting down around the world and restarting and all sorts of crazy things happening because of coronavirus, there's often a story in supply as to why car brands couldn't deliver a lot of cars. And I know BMW had a pretty horrific month compared to June, which was its best ever month. So, yeah, what role is supply playing in the numbers we're seeing?
Well, it certainly seems like there are some brands that are really suffering from supply at the moment. I know that Jaguar Land Rover is battling. Kia has talked openly about its struggles with supply. So clearly, you know, we've seen in lots of the parts of the world, factories being shut in a big way, and obviously that has trickle-on effects. So just spoke to an executive from Isuzu Ute Australia who said that in Thailand, they haven't really had any issues with supply. So a lot of the pickup trucks are still doing pretty well. So it really is a mixed bag. But, you know, of course, in these times, if somebody doesn't really want to wait for a car and they just want to get whatever's available, supply will absolutely play a role. Although I don't think it's the principal player.
Moco, something that I noticed from the numbers this month is that we're really starting to see passenger cars continue to fall off the top of the sales charts. And if you look at like the top 20, for example, there's only a handful of passenger cars which are normally the usual suspects that used to be, you know, top three sellers back in the day. What are your thoughts on how the SUV and utility trend is going at the moment?
Yeah, mate, it's super interesting, isn't it? So SUVs actually, for the first time ever, passed 50% market share. So more than half of all the vehicles sold, and that includes trucks and utes and everything else, was an SUV. So that's a significant departure. And passenger cars were about 20%, or sorry, 25%, I should say. So only about one in four was a hatch or a sedan or a wagon or a people mover. About 20% were utes. So, yeah, you really are seeing now, you know, obviously it's not new news, but the passenger market continues to decline at a pretty significant rate of knots. From the top 20 list, in terms of models, there were 11 SUVs, 4 pickups, and only 5 passenger vehicles in the top 20, and they're the usual suspects. So your Hyundai i30, Mazda 3, Toyota Corolla, Kia Cerato, and Toyota Camry. Actually, while I'm on vehicles, I should probably talk about the top vehicles. So one of the big stories to come out of the month was that it wasn't the Toyota Hilux or Ford Ranger that topped the charts. It wasn't even the Toyota Corolla, which are usually the cars that top the charts. It was actually the Toyota RAV4. Most popular SUV in the country all year has eclipsed the Mazda CX-5, but now it's the most popular vehicle full stop. So 4,309 cars sold, up 78% for the month. Interestingly enough, 80% of those were hybrids. So we know that there was a significant issue with supply for that car. Toyota secured much more stock for the month of July and was actually able to get some of those cars to customers. And as a result, that car spiked. And what that did that's really interesting is because most of those were hybrids, it actually means that hybrid passenger car and SUV sales combined were higher than diesel passenger and SUV sales combined. So take utes out of the equation where it's diesel dominated, and hybrid is now actually ahead of diesel and has a market share of 12.4% for that month. So really, really interesting change in the scenery from that perspective.
If your name is not Toyota, obviously it's pretty tough at the moment, but it seems like Hyundai is doing it tougher than even, you know, the likes of Mazda and some of its other top five rivals. Do we have any insight as to why that might be?
Yeah, look, Hyundai has not been going great. I'm just pulling up the spreadsheet now. So year to date, it looks like its sales are down by 32%. I'm just going to confirm that I've got that right. Yes, down 32%. The market as a whole is down 19%. So it's definitely fallen faster than the whole market. There are a lot of cars in that company's range that have actually fallen by the wayside just a little bit compared to the same time last year. So we see that the loss of the Accent has hurt Hyundai terribly. It no longer has a, you know, fleet-friendly $15,000 P-Plate-ready entry car below that $20,000 mark. So it sold 7,600 Accents to this stage of last year, and this year it's obviously sold none. So that's a huge loss for the brand. But there are other stories to this as well. The iLoad's down, the iMax is down, the Santa Fe is well down. So is the Sonata, the Tucson. It's sort of a tale of woe for Hyundai, actually. And the i30 is down by 28% too. Now, the upside is Hyundai has a lot of new product coming. I did a story a few weeks ago on Car Expert talking about this. There's a heap of new product coming for the company, so it should get a bit of a bump. But if you compare Hyundai to Kia, only a few years ago, Kia was not even half of Hyundai. And now, 2 months this year at least, it's actually been beaten by Kia, and it almost got beaten by Kia again last month. So Hyundai really needs to shake things up just a little bit.
All right, you can head to Car Expert to read the full report on July VFACTS, and we thank you, Mike Costello.
Always a pleasure, guys. Thank you.
Most performance cars live out their days driving in and around city streets, barely getting the chance to stretch its legs, which makes us pretty sad, as that's not what they're designed for. But we like to use them for what they were designed for, and that is a track. Our resident racing driver, Chris Atco Atkinson, is the guy who does this, and he joins us now again. Hello, Atco.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Very well. This time you're behind the wheel of a $207,000 bright yellow Porsche Cayman GT4. You said in your review that you've never driven a Cayman before, so I'm actually keen to hear what your first impressions were of it.
Yeah, right. I heard a lot of good things, and obviously I'm very lucky to get to drive these cars on a track where they're meant to be. Like I said, like it's meant to be an amazing car, but I didn't know what to expect. And it's always funny, you go out there first time on track and you sort of try and get a feeling straight away. But we've basically said we've got to do this in 4 laps. So I've got 4 laps to figure out how to do the quickest time I can, and how to figure out the car. And the crazy thing with that car is I did my quickest lap on the first lap out. Like, it just felt comfortable straight away.
Really? So it was a manual, which is quite unusual. And the fact that your first lap was the quickest, because it always takes a little bit of time to get familiar with the gears and everything, but that's actually quite a surprise. How did you find the manual box?
It was a bit weird for me. All our racing is sequential gearboxes or paddle shifts. The last time I drove a manual car, like a H-pattern box fast, I can't even remember. It's like probably 10 years ago. So, you know, that shift from second to third coming onto the straight, you're going, oh, don't mess this up. Like, trying to do it right. But like a couple of, like literally the outlap and the first flying lap, you figure it out. It's not like it's you mess them up. You're just not 100% confident with them. But it works pretty well. And it's nice to go back to that. It makes you actually drive, makes you think about it, and you've got to be smooth on the gear changes and shifting at the right time. And the thing with that car is that the gears are fairly well spaced, so you aren't actually changing gears too often.
I was going to ask about the gears, because some of the stuff I've read from other publications about the car on the road is that it's geared really long and that's a negative thing. But you were quite positive about the gearing in your review.
Yeah, it is a negative on the road because you can't, like, I just hopped out of the A45 AMG, which has so many gears and is geared just for acceleration. You feel like, wow, that blows my mind and is awesome, like off a roundabout or something like that. But you take it to a track and it's almost, it's changing gears all the time, where the Porsche is actually designed to use the full rev range of the engine. It's got a good wide power band, and that suits the track. And then you're not changing gears all the time. And there's enough power there across the range that it doesn't really affect you. And if you don't have to, like when we go to racetracks, we're always trying to, how do we cut out a gear shift? How can we save a gear shift? Because that's time. So when you take that car to the track, it works perfectly.
This is probably getting a little bit off topic here now, Echo. Would you prefer the PDK with paddle shifters in this instance?
I think it's a difficult question. It's nice on the track, but I think just for general day-to-day living and doing both options, I think you'd go the paddle shift. I know it's probably not the right thing to say, but it would do both jobs on average better. So that would probably be my choice. But it's still nice to go back to the manual. I don't know if anyone will ever learn to drive manuals anymore these days anyway. Which is a worry, but I think the paddle shifts are so good these days and still so engaging, and I find a lot of the cars that I can enjoy just as much with the paddle shift that it's hard to beat.
Atco, I believe I heard before you or Manny mentioned that you haven't had much experience with Cayman at all, let alone the GT model. I too have not had much experience with them, which is something that I'm not very happy about. But I know that having worked with new Porsches for a little while, having them come through the office and everything, I know that there was a bit of controversy about how the latest Caymans sound, because they're mostly four-cylinder until the GT4 came out and then the GTS4 later. On the track is where these kind of engines really shine. Can you talk about how the sound and the overall atmosphere when you're driving it at the limit feels?
I'd say it's still the same sort of feeling. It doesn't really like rock your body. It's not exciting. There's no crazy noise. To be fair, I barely even registered it. But the rest of the car is so engaging that it doesn't matter too much. Like it's a strong, solid engine. But I think I mentioned in the story that it does lack that, the sound and the excitement. But the chassis is just so good. You get caught up in that. And like I remember just going to turn two and watching where the nose was sitting and watching how stable it was as I turned in and back on the power. That was more entertaining for me, as much as I would have liked the engine to go up a level and be a bit more noisy and entertaining. It's still not a disappointing car to drive.
I know we're now getting very off track, but compared to a 911, which I know is not quite as rear-engined as it used to be, but obviously is still slightly different to a Cayman, would you actually prefer a GT4 maybe to a similarly priced 911 because of the way it handles?
I think it would solely depend on what you were going to use it for. I think if you were going to do a lot of track days, straight away you'd go the GT4 because that's what it's built for, and it does it really well. But if you were just doing the odd track day, and I'm still I'm a bit of a fan of the 911s, whether it's because I'm a Subaru driver and I like a boxer engine or I don't know what. But yeah, I lean towards the 911 as a overall package, but there's not many cars that literally felt like a race car on the track. And you could drive it home and drive back to the track and do a ton of laps and it would be perfect. And it would be a challenge to try and improve yourself in it as well. So it ticks a lot of boxes with all of that.
Okay, did you ever get that iconic Porsche back end niggle that the 911s are more famous for when pushing the Cayman around a corner?
I did a bit of drifting in it and it was actually pretty easy to drift. Cool. The only thing I'd say was that when I quickly changed directions on the last three corners basically of our Car Expert test track is that I felt the car get away from me if I wasn't a little bit aggressive on the change of direction. But once you got it sideways, it was quite easy to slide. So you just have to be a little bit patient with that change of direction. You know, the weight's there, the energy's there, so you just got to be mindful of that. But it never scared me. It never caught me out. I'm sure it could, but you've just got to be mindful of it, I guess.
Yeah. And lastly, did you get a chance to drive it off the track?
Briefly, our boss was pretty keen to take it back off me. He didn't leave it with me too long. And it was nice to drive. Like I said, because it goes so fast just in first gear, all of a sudden you're heading towards breaking the speed limit pretty quickly and you haven't even changed gear. So a car like that, it's nice and easy to drive and does, like I said, you can just drive it home, no worries at all. But to really enjoy the car, you've got to actually go so fast that it's probably not appropriate on the road. So that's where it really is a track car and a good option, like in that window, that it's like the brakes was incredible on the track, the engine was strong and it was going to be reliable and the chassis was spot on. So it ticked a lot of boxes for me.
The best part about the Cayman is the practicality too. If you want to drive it to the racetrack, there's plenty of room to put your racing gear in it as well, in the boot and the frunk. So it's all boxes ticked there.
Yeah, options.
You can read ATCO's review now up on the site. And ATCO, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
As you've just heard in VFACTS, it's no secret car dealerships, especially in Victoria at the moment, have taken a giant blow due to COVID-19. A survey conducted by the Victorian Chamber of Commerce has revealed some startling statistics about the job security of these people behind the dealership doors, and unsurprisingly, it's not very promising. To find out more, we are joined by VACC CEO Jeff Gwillam. Thank you for your time, Jeff.
Thank you, Mandy.
What were the key findings of this study?
Well, I think overall we know that the car industry has been dropping on overall volume of sales cars for some time. What we did in this study, we went out and asked a whole bunch of dealers around. It was really focused around JobKeeper. We knew that it was going to be a tough year anyway. But first of all, we had JobKeeper and we were talking to our members around, well, if you think towards the end of the year, if we asked you to give us a position on numbers, what would they be in terms of the amount of staff that you might not have in your organisations anymore? And then, of course, we got the stage four lockdowns in Victoria, and that just put everything into overdrive. So even the figures that we received and we collated out of our survey, they are modest compared to what they're going to be now, because they'll be a lot worse. The six-week shutdown really is well, problematic is an understatement.
There's a lot of people who are also ineligible for JobKeeper 2.0 for people who work in car dealerships. I can't quite figure this out. Why is this?
Yeah. Well, our estimation is that over 80% of dealerships actually can't access JobKeeper. The reason for this, Mandy, is that in our view, the government have made an assumption incorrectly that if you have high turnover, then you have high profits. So they look at a car dealership, they're moving a lot of metal through, and on paper, of course, the turnover is high, but the margins are very, very narrow. In some cases, the margins on a vehicle sale is under 1% of the value of the vehicle. So because of that, $1 billion turnover, which sounds like a phenomenal amount of money, but it's not if you're a large dealership, multi-site or multi-state. You had to reach a threshold of a 50% drop in downturn for the same period last year. And it's really unfair to do that because it just assumes that big businesses make big profits and small businesses don't. And on that basis, the 50% benchmark level was really unachievable by a lot of big dealerships because of the volume of cars and parts that they turn over in a year.
Jeff, so we're recording this on Friday and there have been some changes to JobKeeper announced this morning on the day we're recording. Does that open the door for more dealerships than previously would have been able to access it to get their hands on that money, or are a lot still missing out even under the revised 2.0?
Yeah, look, I think it's we really congratulate the federal government on this. We spoke to them at length about it was really about removing the July anomaly. What happened was is in July, and it happened in hospitality and catering as well because they opened for that 1 month or 5 week period, is that if you had a big flow of work and we had a lot of people buying cars and they were buying cars because the instant asset write-off was $130,000 this year, which means a whole lot of tradies and people in business went and bought cars and utes. We had people downloading their superannuation because a new opportunity opened up, $10,000 on one side of the calendar year, of the financial year, and $10,000 on the other. So there's a good deposit for a car. In some cases, that's the price of a car. You can buy a good car for $20,000. And we also had people on JobKeeper, part-timers, who actually had more money on JobKeeper than they'd ever earned at work. If they were only working a day or so a week, all of a sudden they're on $750 irrespective. So there was this cash flow that hit the market and a lot of people went and bought cars. Now, ordinarily, we would say, Yahoo, that's fantastic. But what it did, it meant that if you had to use the previous quarter to make an assessment for JobKeeper in the next quarter, the September quarter, then June just blew you to pieces. And we argued with government that using that period of time as part of the assessment for JobKeeper was really unfair. They've listened to that, so they'll allow the application of the September quarter as opposed to the June quarter, which is fantastic. But whether or not it will make a huge difference, we don't know. I hope it does. I mean, I hope that some of those dealerships, really look at that and make a different decision about the staff that they will keep on. And even if they don't have any work, I mean, they would still have them employed, potentially on reduced hours. But the important thing here is that some dealerships, a lot of dealerships, and, we'll know probably through next week, but the signals we're getting for some dealerships, well, actually quite a lot of dealerships, says, look, they'll just shut for the 6 weeks over Christmas. Now, nationally, of course, it's different. Nationally, this is a great opportunity for dealerships to really get some parity with other organisations that could access JobKeeper. But in Victoria, metropolitan Victoria, where the COVID-4 shutdown is, I think we've sort of moved past JobKeeper. We've moved into a period of how many people do I really need? Am I going to shut down for 6 weeks? And a lot of them will. And how many people will I need coming out the other side? So that's certainly not a criticism of government, the federal government. It's a timing issue, but the fact that it's there is more likely to see staff retained than not, and we have to say that that's a good thing.
Yeah. On the other end, Jeff, what are some of the flow-on effects if some dealerships never recover from this?
Well, there's two flow-on effects. So one is about supply chain and one is about the activity in the market. So the other thing that we've been critical of government on this is a failure to understand supply chains and industry. So if you want to have a whole lot of repairers open to keep essential vehicles on the roads, that's food, food transport, public transport, trucks, logistics, all of that sort of stuff, you can't shut down 90% of the industry that actually supply parts to the industry and then ask the other half of the industry to actually repair vehicles because they won't be able to get the parts because the dealership's shut. So, we've got multitudes of suppliers of parts in this industry. And of course, big names like Burson's and Repco, we all know them. But a lot of body repairers and vehicle repairers buy parts through dealerships. If those dealerships aren't open, they won't be able to get the parts. So there's a failure here to understand the connectivity between different parts of the industry. So I wanted to just outline that, Mandy, because a lot of people can't see that flow-on effect down from dealerships into service and repair and even right through into aftermarket. In terms of the market more generally, it's hard to say whether dealerships will actually go by the wayside. I don't think they will. I mean, normally that's due to a manufacturer making a decision about whether they'll have cars in a particular market. I think it will cripple a lot of dealerships for a long time. I think they will really struggle to recover, certainly for a year or so, maybe longer, maybe 2 or 3 years coming through the other side. I want to also raise, though, Mandy, the issue of labour and skilled labour, because again, I think that this is something that hasn't had enough focus. A lot of apprentices are in dealerships, and one of the major issues for the automotive industry is that we've had a critical skill shortage for at least 2 decades. There's 30,000 jobs in automotive nationally that aren't filled. What COVID has done is actually stopped the inflow of international skilled labour. Now, the VACC's position has always been look for local labour, look to train a local apprentice, and if you can't find anything in the local market, then you have to look at international labour. That labour's not here. It won't be here for years. I mean, I think people are going to be very nervous around the world shipping themselves off to other countries, given the isolation, and, you know, some of them were really stranded in other countries for a long time once COVID came through. So we will have a severe, well, it'll compound our severe skill shortage. And dealerships have a lot of apprentices in there. Now, we want to, the VACC run a group training company, and that what how that works is we employ apprentices and we put them into host workplaces. We've got 560 apprentices between Victoria and Tasmania. Today, I've had 160 apprentices pass back to me.
Wow.
So I've had 160 automotive apprentices given back to me because there's not enough work in the workplace and they're going to shut the workplace down. By Tuesday next week, I'd expect that number to be 250. Okay, that's a lot of apprentices. Now, holding on to apprentices is bad enough in good times, and what we can't afford to do is to have any leakage there. Now, a lot of our apprentices are under JobKeeper, and that's fantastic, but if they get bored, if they start to wander, if they lose interest, it will be an enormous task. I think it's a 7-year task to regrow the skills base that we will need in automotive, because it's already depleted and we have no international labour to rely on.
So, Jeff, I'm not asking you to solve COVID-19, because if you could do that, you wouldn't be talking to us on the podcast right now.
Yeah.
But is there anything practical that can be done beyond the government programs that are already in place, you think, to try to protect that workforce and to try to secure maybe the future workforce in terms of apprentices that isn't being done now?
Well, look, that's a good question, and thank you for that. We've been in conversation with the government in Victoria about leaving the regular service and repair of vehicles, so logbook servicing or scheduled services, to enable that to happen, so that we've got a safe vehicle fleet and we're looking after the public and to keep a drip feed into industry. The Victorian government has said no. They do not regard the regular and scheduled servicing as vehicles to be important. I think that's appalling. And I think what they're doing, they're saying to consumers, we don't care about your warranty. We don't care about the safety of your vehicle because you can get it repaired if it's critical or essential. But often you don't know that there's something wrong with your car until you plug a computer into the onboard diagnostic port and it tells you there's a problem with the emissions or a problem with the braking system. So again, there's a complete naivety here in government about understanding how cars work and how they protect people. And if I can't plug a scanner in, I can't tell you that airbag's at fault. You can't tell a faulty airbag unless you put a scanner into a car. So the VACC, we are very disappointed that drip feed of work into the industry has been removed. And look, I put out a bulletin yesterday to our members advising them that the Victorian government has removed or that won't allow vehicle servicing to occur unless it's essential or critical. And my feeling is that will be 20,000 people that won't go to work on Monday just through that one statement alone.
Lastly, Jeff, on a bit of a more happier note, do you have any advice or words of encouragement for people in the automotive sector who are struggling at the moment?
Stole my question, Mandy.
I would love to be able to dig deep and find a glittering example of what's ahead of us here. I mean, we have to remain positive as much as we can. And of course, we will come out the other side and people will buy cars and people will get their cars fixed. So we know that will happen. But it's you know, all I can say to employers is hang on. They know this. Reduce your costs. Find a way to get through. Negotiate with your landlord. That's all you can ask them to do. But when you, if you're a big dealership and you've got a huge lending in that dealership, either for vehicles on what we call floor plans or for the multi-site operations, that is a huge expense to that business. And you know, glimmers of hope are hard to find, but all you can do is say to them, just try and find a way through. We're not going to stop buying cars quickly, so that we will bounce back. But we were in a difficult time anyway. The Banking and Finance Royal Commission already slowed down the sale of vehicles because it was almost impossible for consumers to borrow money, and then followed up with COVID. So it's a really challenging time. Yes, things will be better at some point, sometime in the future. My guess is it'll be around March next year that we'll start to see some light coming through. But I'm, you know, forgive me if I'm a little bit worn on this, but I'm very frustrated that the government has really shut off so much work to the industry that it will only render it able to. Most of them, I've been on Zoom calls all morning with members of the industry, and they've just said, "Look, I've got nowhere to go. I'll just shut the joint down."
It'd be frustrating to hear. VACC CEO Jeff Gwilym, we thank you so much for your time.
That's a pleasure, Mandy. I'll talk to you soon. Bye bye.
That puts an end to this week's Car Expert podcast. Now, if you head to the site, there is a really cool review on headlights, J-Wo. And I think even you, Scully, were involved in putting this video and review together. Looked like a lot of fun.
Yes, it was a very big collaborative effort from the Melbourne team. So we assembled four different cars with four different types of headlights. I won't give you too many spoilers, but essentially it was a test to see the different effectiveness between the different types of headlight technology. So we had a Kia Seltos that had a conventional halogen headlight, which is a bit old these days, but it has a projector beam. We had the Suzuki Swift Sport, which the review went live recently, that has a fixed LED headlight. The Skoda Superb Scout, which has a matrix LED headlight, and then we had a couple of BMWs with laser lights. So it was more or less trying to see the differences in how effective the light was in low beam, high beam, and just, you know, seeing whether if you spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on a car with laser lights, whether it's that much better than a conventional LED or matrix LED, which is becoming more and more common these days. So there's a really great video presented by our very own face of car expert, Paul Marrick. And there's also a really extensive written piece on the site as well. So very, very good piece of work. So well done to everyone that did that, and also well worth a read and watch.
Yeah. Can I ask you how late that night was when you were filming? Because obviously it all has to be done at night. It would have been very late, I would assume.
Yeah, it was quite late, and we had to film quite a far way from home. So it was it was a late night Macca's run and a, you know, 10:30, 11 o'clock arrival at home. So fun times.
But if you look at the video, it was well worth it. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it. So, if you've got a spare 15, 16 minutes or so, take a look. Scully, what cars are in the garage next week?
So obviously it's a pretty bare cupboard in Melbourne as everything dials down for the next 6 weeks, but up in Sydney there's some really cool stuff. Kurt is driving the Audi TT sort of through this week and into the next, and then from there he's jumping into the Audi S7. So it's been a good couple of weeks for Kurt. That'll be some really interesting stuff. Audi's new cars are really sort of, they've found their form, it seems. So I'm very interested to see what Kurt thinks of that S7. We've also got a Peugeot 5008 going through the garage and a Peugeot Expert the week after that. So a couple of very different vehicles. And then up in Brisbane, we've got Will Stopford currently driving the Nissan Juke. I'm hearing good things from him about that car, and I've seen one on the road and it looks quite sharp. So interested to hear his thoughts. And hopefully, depending on what happens with the COVID situation, at some point we will be getting behind the wheel of the new Isuzu D-Max. But we will see on that one.
Podcast at carexpert.com.au. Send us an email if you've got any feedback for the podcast. And if you are listening, give us a top rating. We love you for it. Scott Colley and James Wong, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mandy.
RH 5 out of 5.